I guess you'd do it differently, I said. I did do it differently, he snapped. I made sure your mother grew up far away from the dangers of my life. How'd that work out? I asked him. Let's ask Mom. Oh, wait, we can't. She's dead. There was a sudden silence. I'm not sure if the sunlight literally dimmed for a few seconds or not. But the Svartov suddenly drifted even farther away from us. The old man's voice was a quiet rumble. What did you say to me, boy? She's dead, I said, enunciating. Your daughter, who you stashed somewhere safe for her protection, is dead now. You have no stones to throw at me. The old man looked like something carven from old ivory. He said nothing. The monsters already did try to kill Maggie, and I stopped them, I said. And if they try again, I'll stop them again. She doesn't need somewhere safe, but she does need her dad. How dare you, the old man whispered. I might not be the best parent in the whole world, I said, but I'm here. I'm in her life. And there's no substitute for that. None. There never was. There never will be. You idiot, Ebenezer said through clenched teeth. Do you know what these hosts of yours are capable of? Living up to their word, I spat. Boy, he said, don't push me. Why? What are you going to do?
Let me vanish into the foster care system?
For my own good, of course. The old man's head rocked back as if I'd slapped him. Mom died when I was born, I said in a monotone. Dad, when I was coming up on kindergarten. And you just let me be alone. Ebenezer turned from me and hunched his shoulders. Maybe you thought you were protecting me, I continued without inflection. But you were also abandoning me, and it hurt. It left scars. I didn't even know you existed, and I was still angry with you. I watched the children pursue Mouse. He could run for hours without getting winded. They were all having a ball. She's been through enough. I'm not putting her through that, too. The back of his neck and his bald pate were both turning red. I heard his knuckles pop as his blunt, strong hands clenched into fists. Boy, he growled, you aren't thinking straight. You aren't thinking this through. One of us isn't. Your mother is dead, Ebenezer said. Your father is dead. The woman who bore your child is dead. And you are the common denominator. Can't you see that? Can't you see that it's necessary to set your own feelings aside? I felt a flash of rage and pain so intense that for a second I thought I was about to lose control, and it had nothing to do with the winter mantle. What I see, I said, is a little girl who needs her father to love her. I can't do that if I'm not there. You're wrong. Maybe, I said, but she's my child. It's my call. He shook his head. And since I've noticed that my life at times resembles a badly written Mexican soap opera, I continued, I want you to know something. What? I think that right now you're considering protecting her by grabbing her and stashing her somewhere safe. If you go through with it, I'm going to take her back. Over your dead body if necessary, sir. The old man turned to stare at me, his face a thundercloud. I stared back. I didn't blink. Lad, Ebenezer said, the faint burr of a Scots accent that entered his voice. You're walking somewhere you don't want to go. Not the first time. Not the last. The old man thrust out a pugnacious jaw and drew in a breath. Gentlemen, said a new voice, deep and rich. Gentlemen, excuse me. The old man and I both turned our glares on the intruder. A Svartov stood before us, clad in a suit of dark blue silk. He was taller than Austri and heavier with muscle. His expression was calm and absolutely resolute. Gentlemen, you are guests in my home. This display of yours is unseemly at best. I blinked and looked around slowly. The play in the garden had stopped. The Svartalf children had withdrawn to hide behind their parents. Maggie stood halfway between the other children and her family, poised on one foot as if set to flee, both her hands clutching desperately at Mouse's mane. The big dog stood between the child and us, giving me a very disapproving look. I guess we hadn't kept our voices as quiet as we thought we had.
Etri, my grandfather said.
He nodded his head once and said,
"We're having a personal discussion."
Etri, the head of the Svartalf embassy, gave Ebenezer a look devoid of sympathy or understanding.
"Have it elsewhere. You're frightening my people's children. While you are in my house, McCoy, you will conduct yourself with courtesy and decorum."
The statement was flat, uncompromising, and there was not even the subtle hint that it might entertain the possibility of some other outcome. I raised an eyebrow at the Svartalf. I knew he was well respected in the supernatural community, which generally translated to considerable personal power, but only a fool squared off against Ebenezer McCoy. "Yes, I'm aware of the implications of that statement. I've been doing it for like 10 minutes. The old man took a deliberate breath and then looked around. His eyes lingered on Maggie, and suddenly he seemed to deflate slightly. It was like watching him age a decade or two over the course of a few sentences. And I suddenly really thought about the things I'd said in anger, and I felt ashamed.
Of course, the old man said.
I formally apologize that the discussion got out of hand and that I disturbed your people's children. I offer no excuse and ask you to overlook my discourtesy.
Yeah, I said. Same here. Me too.
Etri regarded Ebenezer for a moment and then glanced at me and rolled his eyes a little before nodding.
"I believe this visit is over," whispered McCoy. "I will send your effects to the front gate."
"No, wait," I said. "Sir, I didn't mean—"
"Of course you are right, Etri," Ebenezer said, his voice brusque. He started to turn away.
"Sir," I said.
"Time to go," Ebenezer said, his voice weary.
"Work to be done."
And he walked out. I hadn't seen Austri enter the garden, but the security guard quietly stepped forward to tail the old man. I made a go-easy gesture at Austri. The Svartalf kept his expression stiff for a second, but then something like compassion softened it, and he nodded in reply to me. Etri watched him go, then gave me an unreadable look, shook his head, and walked away. The other Svartals went with him. Once everyone was gone, Maggie hurried over to me and threw her arms around my waist. I peeled her off and picked her up and held her.
"Was it my fault?" she asked me, her voice quavering. I wanted to talk to Grandpa, but I couldn't make the words happen. I didn't mean to make him mad and go away."
My throat grew tight and I closed my eyes before any tears escaped.
"Not your fault, Pumpkin. That was so not your fault. You did fine."
She clung to my neck, hard enough to be uncomfortable.
"But why was he mad?"
"Sometimes grown-ups disagree with each other," I said. "Sometimes they get angry and say things that hurt when they don't mean to. But it will pass, you'll see."
"Oh," she said.
Mouse came up to me and leaned against my legs in silent support.
"Will Grandpa come for Christmas?" she asked. "Maybe he will." "Okay," she said. "Are you mad at me?"
"No," I said, and kissed the side of her head.
"You're my pumpkin." "Good," she said. "I still want pancakes."
"Let's go make them," I said. Mouse's tail thumped hopefully against my leg. But first, we all stood there for a moment, the three of us.
taking comfort in one another's proximity.
Chapter 5. Of course it went badly, Karen said. It was a fight with someone in your family. Believe me, family fights are the worst. The family hasn't even been assembled yet, and there's fights, I complained.
Looks pretty assembled to me, from what I've seen,
she said, her tone dry.
Yeah, well, I've never had much opportunity to fight with family, I said.
I have, she said. Everyone cares about everyone else, so when you get mad and say something horrible, it hurts that much more. And too many things go unsaid. That's the worst, I think. Everyone thinks they know one another better than they probably do, so you fill in the silences with things the other person never actually said, or thought about saying. I scowled and said, "Is that your professional opinion, Dr. Murphy?" She snorted, fell silent, and squeezed my hand with hers. Her grip was small and strong and warm. We held hands a lot these days. I'd come over to cook her some dinner. My cooking skills are modest but serviceable, and we'd both had our fill of oven-roasted chicken and potatoes and a fresh salad. Karen was having a hard time moving around in the kitchen, between her knee, her shoulder, and all the braces she had to wear to keep them more or less immobilized. And she'd gotten sick of the available delivery food after only a few weeks of being laid up. I came over a couple of nights a week and cooked for her when the Carpenter kids were available to babysit Maggie. Speaking of doctors, I said, all smooth, what did the doctor say today? Round one of surgery went okay, she said. She exhaled and laid her head against my arm. We were sitting on the couch in her living room, with her injured leg propped up on an ottoman I'd gotten for her. She was a bitty thing, 5 and not much, if a very muscular 5 and not much. Blonde hair, clean but bedraggled. Hard to keep it styled when you've got to do everything with one hand. No makeup. And she looked tired. Karen Murphy found the lack of work during her recovery exhausting. She'd collected the injuries on my behalf. They weren't my fault, or that's what I kept telling myself. But at the end of the day, she'd put herself in a place to get hurt because I'd asked her to be there. You could argue free will and causality and personal choice all you wanted, but the fact was that if I hadn't gotten her involved, she'd probably have been in one of her martial arts classes at this time of evening. Round 2 can start next week, she continued, speaking in her professional voice, the detached one that didn't have any emotion in it, used mostly when something really, really upset her. Then it's just 3 more months of casts and stupid braces, and then I can start 6 months of therapy while they wean me off the painkillers. And after all of that is done, if it goes very, very well, he thinks I may be able to walk without a cane, as long as I don't have to do it very fast. I frowned. What about your training? There was damage, she said, her voice becoming not so much quiet as dead. In the knee, shoulder, elbow. They're hoping to get me back to 50%, the basic function, not athletic activity. I remembered her scream when Nicodemus had kicked her in the knee. The ugly, wet, crunching sound when he'd calmly forced her arm out of its socket, tearing apart her rotator and hyperextending her elbow at the same time. He'd done it deliberately, inflicted as much damage, as much pain as he could. I don't get to be me anymore, she whispered. She'd been injured before, and she'd come back from it, but everyone has limits. She was only human. We sat there in silence while her old grandfather clock ticked steadily. Is there anything that, she began. I shook my head. When it comes to healing, magic isn't much ahead of medicine at this point. Our people go to study from yours, unless you want to get Faustian. No, she said firmly. I nodded. There wasn't much else I could say. I'm sorry, I said finally. She gave her head a tiny shake. Don't, she said. I cried about it earlier, and I'll do it again later. But right now, I don't want to think about it. Talk about something else. Try to think of something. Came up empty. So instead, I kissed her. You are the last of the red hot raconteurs, Dresden, she murmured against my mouth. But then she closed her eyes and leaned into the kiss, and everything else started going away. Kissing was something I had to be cautious about. After about 20 seconds of feeling her breath mingling with mine, the winter mantle started going berserk with naked lust. The damned aura of power Mab had given me let me do some incredible things, but the constant drumbeat of sex and violence it kept playing at my thoughts and emotions never went away. So at 20 seconds, I started breathing faster, and at 30, my head was besieged by impulses of things to do with Karen. And by the time a minute had gone by, I was forcing myself to remember that I was stronger than I realized, and to be careful not to clench my hands on her and haul her bodily against me. Though, to be fair, she was reacting in almost exactly the same way, and she didn't have an aura of wicked fairy power to blame it on. So maybe it wasn't the mantle at all. Maybe it was just me, which was scary. Or maybe it was just us, which was actually kind of an amazing thought. Her fingers twined in my hair and gripped hard as she gasped, "Okay, you are a genius of conversation. This is exactly what I need." "Are you sure?" I began to ask. "God, stop talking, Harry," she growled, and her hand got more intimate, sliding under my shirt. "I'm tired of waiting. You're tired of waiting. We're tired of waiting." I made a vague sound of agreement that sort of turned into a growl. Then her mouth found mine again and muffled the sound, and my heart rate accelerated to the level of frantic teenager. So did hers. Our breaths were coming out faster, synced. Then my hand slid over her hip, and she let out a sound of need that robbed me of the ability to think about anything at all. "Now," she gasped. Then she made a bunch of sounds that sort of had a consonant and a vowel as clothes got removed, or at least rearranged. I helped her a little with mine, because after all, she only had one hand to work with. She kept urging me to hurry, though without words. And then I was kneeling on the floor, and she was spread beneath me on the couch, our hips aligning, and I leaned down to find her mouth again, and I felt her stiffen with sudden pain. Felt the catch in her breath as it hit her. Her shoulder or her leg, I couldn't tell, but damn it, she was supposed to be recovering, not being athletic. Her eyes opened all the way. She blinked at me a few times and asked, "What?" I mumbled, I don't know if... She seized my shirt in her good hand and dragged me toward her, eyes lambent. "I'm not made of glass. Harry, I want this. For once in your life, would you please shut your mouth, stop thinking, and just do me?" I looked down and said, Karen looked down and then up at me. She rolled her eyes up to the ceiling for a second, and I swear to you, she must have had an even better sexual frustration face than I did. Then she sort of deflated, which made two of us, and let out her breath in a slow sigh. "Dresden," she said, "this chivalrous self-identity thing you have going is often endearing, but right now I want to kick it in the nuts." "I can't hurt you," I said. "I'm sorry." She rolled her eyes again and pulled me down so that she could put an arm around my neck while I carefully kept any weight off her. She kissed my temple and said, very gently, "I know. You dear idiot." I put my arms around her carefully and hugged her back. And that was when someone knocked briskly at the front door.
I jumped up on déshabille and tried to rearrange my clothes.
Murphy sort of flopped about, trying to do the same with one hand and two largely immobile limbs. We both stopped to notice, then to notice the other noticing, and then burst out into absurd laughter while we continued trying to dress. "The door?" Murphy tittered, dragging a quilted throw across her bare legs. I managed to stagger to it, glanced out the peephole, and recognized the caller, and opened the door slightly while using it to hide the fact that my pants had fallen back to my knees. The fuzz stood on the porch. Two men were waiting there politely, with polite, neutral cop faces. I recognized one of them, though it had been a while since I'd seen him. He was on the tall side of medium height, good-looking with a regulation high and tight for his dark hair, although he'd added a thick mustache to his look that admittedly set off his blue eyes very well. He wore a suit too expensive for his pay grade and had a thick manila envelope tucked under one arm. "Detective Rudolph," I said as I finished pulling my pants on, in a tone of voice generally reserved for phrases like, "Crucify him," or "I'm going to cut your throat," I continued, "how nice to see you again." "Dresden," Rudolph said, smirking for a moment. "Great, two birds with one stone. Is Ms. Murphy home?" He put a little emphasis on the title, just to remind everyone that she wasn't a cop anymore. I wanted to smack him. I restrained myself in a manly fashion and said, "It isn't a good time. She's still recuperating from her injuries." "The ones from last winter," Rudolph noted. I arched a brow. Murphy's injuries from our little outing with a pack of psychotic killers and sociopathic malcontents hadn't involved gunshot wounds, and they hadn't happened at a crime scene. The medical establishment hadn't needed to report them to the police, which meant that the cops had gone sniffing around to find out about them. That wasn't good. Murphy had been helping me with a smash-and-grab operation. We'd robbed hell, or at least a hell. The target hadn't been anything inside Chicago PD's jurisdiction, but we'd kind of had to get there through the basement of a bank, and it had gotten pretty thoroughly wrecked as a result. Plus there had been the guards, and the police who had surrounded the bank, and the cops we'd gone through on the way out. We'd worked hard to make sure no one would be killed, but one of our associates had slaughtered a guard anyway. That made us accomplices to murder, at least, as far as the law was concerned. And they weren't wrong. "Yeah, those injuries," I told him, "so buzz off."
"Or what?"
Rudolph asked mildly.
"Or, unless you have a warrant to enter or some kind of believable probable cause, I imagine Murphy sues your department's ass to kingdom come."
"Maybe I'll insist," Rudolph said, smiling. "I'd love to see that," I told him, and I meant it. The mantle was talking to me again, advising me that if I wasn't going to vent some of my built-up tension on a willing woman, then beating the arrogant stuffing out of Rudolph would be an appropriate substitute.
"Nah," the second cop said in a bored, distant voice. "You wouldn't, sir."
I eyed the other guy. He was about 5'6" in all three dimensions. I seriously couldn't remember the last time I'd seen a guy built so solidly. He wore a tailored suit, because I doubted anything fit him off the rack, but it was made of neutral, plain materials, meant to blend into the background of the business world. His salt and pepper hair was buzzed short, and his face was rough with beard shadow that I suspected appeared about 10 seconds after he was done shaving. Something about the way the man held himself, the way his eyes were focused on nothing in particular, put me on notice that he knew what he was doing better than most. I wasn't familiar with the cops and internal affairs the way I was with special investigations or the beat cops in the neighborhoods I knew.
"They partnered you with Rudy, huh?" I said. "Harry Dresden."
"Detective Bradley," he said.
"Sir, it would be in Ms. Murphy's best interest to speak to us now."
"Or we could do it downtown," Rudolph said. "I don't care which."
"Rudolph," I said in a pleasant voice,
Do you know how long it takes to wash dried blood from a broken nose out of a mustache? Harry, Karen said from the couch, reproof in her voice. Dial it down a notch. She waved an apologetic hand at me, out of sight of the men at the door. Let's just get it over with, huh? I glowered at the men and said, I reserve the right to kick Harry, Murphy sighed. Ask you to leave if it looks like she's getting tired, I continued smoothly. I looked past Rudolph to the older man and said, okay. Why you, Rudolph said. Bradley, the human tank, put a hand on Rudolph's shoulder. His fingers squeezed slightly, and Rudolph shut his mouth, and then shot him a quick, hard look. Sir, Bradley said, it's in no one's interest to strain an injured woman unnecessarily. We'll be brief. I growled and said, fine, come in. They did, and asked to sit. Whatever. I didn't sit down. I went and stood behind Karen, leaning against the wall with my arms folded. Murphy, Bradley said. Karen nodded at him warily. I knew her enough to recognize some respect in the gesture, if no affection. Bradley? Out with it, Rudolph. What are you doing here? Rudolph opened a manila envelope and tugged out several pieces of paper with color prints of photos on them. He tossed them onto the coffee table. I picked them up and gave them to Karen without taking my eyes off the cops. She leafed through the pictures, and I felt her tension growing as she did. She passed me the pictures. One of them was a still from a security take on a Chicago street. I didn't recognize the location exactly, but I recognized the blurred shot of Murphy in her little SUV speeding down the street in heavy winter conditions. The others were shots from outside the bank and from security cameras inside. There had been enough bad weather and enough magic in the air that the shots were all blurry and distorted, but one of them was of a couple of guys coming out the bank door. One of them was of average height, and the second was very tall. It was a shot of me and a mercenary named Gray during our egress of the heist taken from a distance. The veil we'd been under must have flickered, or else the shot was from before it solidified and hid us from everyone. As it was, there wasn't much but outlines. Our faces couldn't really be made out in the distorted images. Still, there aren't a lot of NBA-sized guys robbing banks in Chicago, or anywhere. All of the other images were just as vague, or worse, but had the recognizable silhouette of the same tall fellow. Though none of them showed my face, except the last one. In that one, I was sprinting down a sidewalk, and anyone with eyes, which is to say most people who might wind up on a jury, could recognize the image as me. That shot of you, Rudolph said to Karen, came from the same day you wound up with your injuries. Hell of a coincidence. How? She asked calmly. Rudolph, everyone in Chicago gets on a security camera or three every day of their lives. They aren't all speeding in dangerous conditions, Rudolph said. Does Chicago have AI doing traffic stops? Karen asked. Now that you've cleaned up all the corruption in town. Speeding down main streets during an ice storm, Bradley said. Near reports of gang violence at the same time. I was trying to make it home in time for my shows, she said, her tone dry. Car ended up wrecked, didn't it? The follies of youthful impatience, Karen said, and pointed at her casts. Been pretty clear about that. Bradley nodded. Talk to your doctor. Says he hasn't ever seen injuries like yours from a wreck. Too precise. Says they're clearly directed violence. He's wrong, Karen said, and violating HIPAA. And your known associate, Bradley continued as though she hadn't spoken. We've got images of him, too. Beautiful picture of you, Dresden, Rudolph said. On the sidewalk outside a building where we found a body the next day. He consulted a little notebook in his pocket. One Harvey Morrison, CPA. Karen gave him her cop face, and I made do with my wizard face, but it was tough. My stomach had just dropped out. Harvey Morrison had died badly, despite my efforts to save his life. Cops get a little funny about the corpses of murdered men and women, particularly when they're squares, unconnected to the world of crime. Failing to save someone isn't quite the same thing as murdering them, but from the outside, the two can look almost identical. Bradley continued. Morrison was a frequent customer at Verity Trust Bank, which was robbed the next day. His specific vault was opened during the robbery, during which a number of explosions and a great deal of gunfire occurred. He nodded at the pictures. Those other images are of a suspect between 6'8" and 6'11", presumably one of the bank robbers. He looked up at me blandly. 6'9", isn't it, Dresden? I ate all of my Wheaties every morning at breakfast, I said.
Wise ass, Rudolph hissed. Keep on cracking wise. I've got your ass now.
Cracking wise? I asked him. I shook my head at Bradley and hooked a thumb at Rudolph. Who talks like that?
He might be right, Bradley said quietly.
He looked from me to Karen.
We're digging. We're good at it.
You are, Karen acknowledged. Bradley nodded.
Your family's done good work in this town, Murphy. Might be a good thing for you both if you talk to us before we dig up anything more.
Karen didn't look at me, and I didn't look at her. We didn't need to check in on this particular subject. Like most of the rest of the world, the cops didn't have much time for the world of the supernatural. They would look at us blankly if we tried to tell them about the heist run by demon-possessed 2,000-year-old maniacs, and including ourselves, a shapeshifter, a Sasquatch, a one-man army, and a pyromancer. They'd figure we were going for an insanity plea and run us in. The capacity of humanity to deny what is right in front of it is staggering. Hell, Rudolph had seen a loup-garou tear apart a Chicago police station with his own eyes, and he was still in denial.
I don't know what to tell you, Karen said. In that picture, I'm just trying to get home out of the storm. I don't know anything about this accountant.
And I barely know anything about anything, I said, except that there are maybe 1,000 people in Chicagoland who are 6'8" or taller. These pictures could be any of them. Hope you got a real big lineup room.
In this picture, the one of you? Bradley asked politely.
I think I was running to catch a train, I said. I was trying for guileless. Bradley clearly wasn't buying it. He eyed us both and then nodded and let out a breath.
Yeah, okay.
Rudolph stood up briskly and said, Well, we tried. Bradley gave Rudolph a steady look. Then he stood and said quietly,
I'll be right out. Wait for me.
I'm not your fucking junior partner, Rudolph snarled. I am your superior officer.
Yes, sir, Bradley said, and I'll be right out.
Rudolph gave him a disgusted look. Then he eyed me, pointed at me with his index finger, and said,
I'm looking forward to seeing you locked up, Dresden.
Yeah,
keep looking, I told him.
Rudolph smirked at me, then at Karen. She stared at him. She's got a good stare. Rudolph's smirk faded and he abruptly left without another word.
Prick,
Karen breathed after the door closed behind him. She eyed Bradley and said, Him? Really? Bradley shrugged, a tectonic shift of massive shoulders.
Job's gotta get done. Someone's gotta do it.
Yeah, Karen said quietly.
Dogs are out, he said. Matter of time before they get a scent. You and Dresden both cut it close for a long time. This time, you went over the line.
Don't know what you're talking about, Karen said.
Crap,
Bradley replied. He rubbed a hand over his buzzed scalp.
Okay, that's how you want to play it. We play it all the way out.
Do your job, Karen said. You always have.
Yeah, Bradley shook his head.
Rudolph let it get personal. Unprofessional. Sorry about that.
I don't expect any better from him, Karen said. Not your fault.
Hey, I said, why does Internal Affairs have this one? Why not homicide?
He shrugged. Murphy was one of ours, I guess. You were too, sort of.
Karen stared at him intently for a moment. Then she said, thanks for coming by, Bradley.
Bradley nodded politely. Yeah, thanks for your time.
I hope you feel better soon, Ms. Murphy. He left, too, shutting the door carefully behind him, as if he wanted to avoid cracking it in half by accident. Maybe it had been a problem for him before. I let out a long breath after he left. Then I went to the door and watched them depart and nodded to Karen once they were gone. What did you get from him? I asked. I didn't catch it.
Because I was one of theirs, he guesses, Murphy said. Bradley doesn't guess about anything. He doesn't know why IA has the case.
I rubbed at the spot between my eyes and growled, someone is pulling strings behind the scenes. They got the case bumped over to one of their people, Rudolph.
And Marcone owns Rudolph, Karen said. She pursed her lips. Or so we've assumed.
I grunted.
Who else could have him? Who else has so much influence in this town?
She shook her head. Asking the wrong person in this room.
Ha, I said. Something else to look into. What can we expect?
Bradley's like a starving dog with a bone, she said. He gets on a trail, he doesn't get off it. He doesn't sweep things under the rug, doesn't play the game.
No wonder he's his age and still junior to Rudolph, I said. Fortunately, we have a little thing called fact on our side. We didn't kill Harvey, or the guy at the bank.
Karen snorted. We were there and were lying to the police about it. That would get us put away for a while, all by itself. But our DNA was at the scene, and they might turn up eyewitnesses who saw us on the street, or find more images from a camera somewhere, or someone could make some more evidence happen, I said.
She nodded.
They could make a case out of it. This could wind up badly.
What do we do about it, then?
She arched an eyebrow at me.
Do? What are we, the villains in Bradley's detective novel? Should we try to warn him off the case, destroy some evidence, set someone else up to take the fall?
I grunted. Still. Not much we can do, she said quietly, except find out more about what's going on. I've got a few channels left. I'll check them.
I'll add looking into Rudolph's sponsor to my list, I said.
She nodded. Think this will interfere with the weirdness convention?
Might be meant to, I said. I thought about it for a long moment and then said,
when I go, call Butters.
Karen quirked an eyebrow at me.
This shows every sign of becoming a Sharknado, I said. Have him get the word out to everyone. I mean everyone on the Paranet.
What word?
To keep their eyes open. Sing out if they see anything. And to be ready, I said.
Someone's cooking something big. I can smell it.
Karen nodded and her gaze flicked to the grandfather clock against the wall.
You've still got a little time before you need to be back, she said.
Yeah.
She nodded. Her blue eyes were very direct.
Come here.
I arched an eyebrow.
Things haven't really changed on that score. I'm not sure that...
She let out a wicked little laugh.
Adapt and overcome, Harry. I'm intelligent, and you've at least got a decent imagination. Between the two of us, we'll come up with something.
Her eyes narrowed.
Now, come here.
It would have been incredibly impolite to refuse the lady. So I went.
Chapter 6.
I might have been feeling pretty smug on my way back to the car. But my babysitter had an early morning, so as pleasant as it sounded, there would be no staying around for more. I had to go do the responsible dad thing. I was whistling as I got in the Munstermobile and got it to roar to life. The car was an old hearse from the 40s, painted in shades of dark blue and purple, with flames on the hood and front fenders. It was not subtle. It was not anywhere close to subtle. But I figured that since I wasn't either, that it made an entirely appropriate vehicle for me. The car growled its way to life, and I turned and put one arm on the backrest of the front seat to look behind me as I pulled out of Karen's driveway and nearly had a freaking heart attack. Two monsters sat in the back seat.
My reflexes kicked in as I flinched,
twisting at the waist to bring up my left hand, the one with my makeshift shield bracelet. I let out a garbled, incoherent cry as my will slammed through it, and the copper band exploded with a small cloud of green-yellow sparks as the shield came up between me and the threat. My right hand locked into a rigid claw, and a small sphere of the same color of green-yellow energy gathered within the cage of my fingers, spitting and hissing with vicious heat. The wavering, unsteady light flickered and flashed with manic irregularity, and I got a chance to process the threat. Neither of the monsters was moving, and both of them were beautiful. The one on my left was a woman who looked like she had come to a glorious autumn of youthful beauty. Her hair was darker than an undertaker's grave, and her silver-gray eyes threw back the light of my readied magic in flashes of green and gold. Her teeth were white and perfect, and her smile looked sharp enough to cut a throat. She was wearing a white suit and sat with her legs crossed gorgeously and her hands folded in her lap.
"New colors," she said, her voice velvety smooth and calm. "The shield used to be blue. What changed?"
"He made an alliance with a powerful guardian entity," said the second monster, a woman seated beside the first. She was as lean as a rod of rebar, but colder and harder, and her opalescent green eyes were too big to be strictly human. Silver-white hair fell to her shoulders, today in a fine silken sheet. Her voice sounded calm and precise, and she wore a glacier blue dress that belonged on the runway.
"It does not interfere with his duties."
I looked back and forth between the two women. My heart rate began to slow as my conscious mind started to catch on to the fact that I was not, apparently, under attack. Which was not to say that I was not in danger. I silently counted to five while I took a slow breath and decided to be calm and cautious and polite. "Lara Wraith," I said to the first monster, inclining my head slightly. Then I turned to the second and did the same, only a shade more deeply. "Queen Mab."
"So nice to see you again, Harry," Lara said, her sharp smile widening as she tucked a lock of dark hair behind her ear. "I love your hair. You look absolutely wolfish. How long has it been?"
"Since that mess on the island," I said. "How's the vampire queen business?" There was something merry in her eyes as she widened them. "Booming. Sometimes I think I might be about to explode at the prospect of all the marvelous opportunities that have been opening to me." "As long as you don't do it in my car," I said. "Hi, Mab." The second monster stared at me for a silent moment. Mab was the OG wicked fairy, the queen of air and darkness, and her tolerance for my usual insouciance had limits. It had such limits I still had a small lump on my skull that hadn't gone away ever since she'd smashed my noggin against the inside of an elevator. She stared at me the way a cat stares at any creature of about the right size to be eaten, and said,
"It is, in fact, my car."
"Ah," I said, "right, well, it's a company car." Mab continued as if I hadn't spoken.
and Ms. Wraith is welcome to explode within it or not, as she sees fit.
I said, I think she was employing a metaphor, particularly during such a shocking display of bad grace as you are engaging in at the moment. She gave my hands a pointed look and then stared back at my eyes.
Do you mean to attack my person and my guest or not, my knight?
I twitched and remembered that my shield and the energy for an offensive strike were still glowing and pulsing between us. I relaxed my will and let the spells fade out until there was nothing left but a drizzle of inefficiently transferred energies falling as campfire sparks from my bracelet. Oh, right, I said. Excuse me.
I regret my knight's excessive impulse control issues, Mab said, turning to Lara. I trust it has not cast a sour tone upon this meeting.
On the contrary, Lara said, I find it rather charming. Mab's expression was entirely unreadable.
Your response does nothing to increase my good opinion of you, Ms. Wraith. My knight needs no encouragement.
Hey, I said. Lara's eyes wrinkled at the corners. Think of it as you would someone who had encountered a novel kind of food. She looked at me, and her eyes turned a few shades paler.
Something substantial and rarely obtained.
Mab considered that for a moment. Then she smiled, her scary smile. I mean, most of what Mab does is sort of scary, but her smile is just unnerving.
Just so long as you understand that my knight is a part of my house, do not attempt to eat my porridge, Ms. Wraith. You will find it neither hot nor cold nor just right, because unlike Goldilocks, the bears will have eaten you. Am I understood?
Entirely, Lara said, inclining her head to Mab. Her eyes lingered on me for a moment.
Are you sure what I ask isn't too much trouble? Such things are part and parcel of his duties, Mab said, assuming you find him acceptable.
Oh, my, Lara said, glancing at me again. Oh, yes. I didn't much like the sound of where this conversation was going, so I cleared my throat and said, Ladies, I'm sitting right here. I can hear you.
Then you shall have no trouble understanding your orders, Mab said. Ms. Wraith is owed 3 favors by the Winter Court.
3? I blurted. I had to fight for my life through Arctis Tor and slug it out with an elder phobophage just to earn 1 favor. Mab's eyes swiveled to me.
And you were repaid appropriately for your deeds.
I got a donut.
It is hardly my concern if you wasted your favor upon something so frivolous, Mab said.
I scowled. What the hell did she do?
She used her mind, Mab said, unlike some.
Hey, I said.
She has indicated that she wishes to collect upon these favors, Mab said. I have already agreed to 1. I place the responsibility for providing the substance of the remaining 2 in your hands.
I blinked and then narrowed my eyes.
You what?
Mab blinked her eyes and appeared to, just barely, avoid rolling them in exasperation.
2 favors. She may ask them of you during the approaching summit. You will provide whatever she asks, with as much energy and sincerity and forethought as you are capable of employing. You will not fail me in this.
Here's the thing, I said. I'm already kind of busy. You know that. I'm guarding the senior council and liaisoning between the council and Fairy already.
My time and attention are infinitely more important than yours, Mab said. You now have more work. Cease your whining, desist from your dalliances, and do your duty.
2 favors, I said.
No more, no less, Mab said.
Just anything she asks, you expect me to do?
I expect her to show respect for my court and my resources, Mab said. I expect her to ask nothing of you that she would be unwilling to ask from me. Within those constraints, yes. I sputtered and said, suppose she asks me to steal something. I expect you to acquire it. Suppose she asks me to burn down a building. I expect a mountain of fine ash. Suppose she asks me to kill someone. I expect their corpse to be properly disposed of, Mab said. She leaned forward and narrowed her eyes slightly.
For you, to do anything less would be for you to cast shame and dishonor upon my name, upon my throne, and upon all of Winter.
Her voice dropped to a whisper.
I invite you to contemplate the consequences of that.
I didn't meet her eyes. I'd seen the kind of thing Mab would do to someone who merely displeased her, much less made her look bad. My predecessor begged me to kill him. He'd been a monster when he'd had my job. But Mab had crushed him into a broken, whimpering mass of cells before she'd allowed him to die. And if I gave her a reason, she would do the same to me. No, she'd do worse. A lot worse. I glanced at Lara, who was watching me with a much less inhuman, but no less unreadable version of Mab's feline expression. As the effective queen of the White Court, Lara was a card-carrying monster. She was intelligent, driven, and dangerous as hell. Rumor was that she owned politicians coast to coast in the United States now, and that her ambition was driving her to reach even further. Lara was perfectly capable of asking me to do something beyond the pale of any functioning conscience. But Lara was damn smart, too. She had to know that I had limits, that my compact with Mab hadn't changed that. If she told me to do something unconscionable, I was going to tell her where she could shove it, which would get me killed, overkilled, uber-killed. I looked back at Mab. Her face was blank granite, immovable. Lara was a ruling peer under the Unseelie Accords, the Geneva Conventions of the supernatural world. If I said no, if I defied Mab in front of her, I was pretty sure I would get the Prometheus treatment at the very least. But if I said yes, I could find myself in even more trouble. If I knew one thing about paying off favors that were part of a fairy bargain, it was that they were never, ever simple. I had nothing but lousy choices. So what else was new? Fine, I said. Whatever.
Excellent, Mab said. Ms. Wraith?
Lara nodded, her large, luminous eyes never leaving my face.
Acceptable. Then our business is concluded, for now, Mab said.
There was a sudden surge of icy cold wind, so out of place in the summer evening that the windows of the car glazed over with a misty condensation, and I was forced to blink my eyes and shield them with one hand. When I could see again, Mab and Lara were gone, and I was alone in the Monstermobile. Drama queen, I muttered, and started rolling down the windows. A few minutes later, the glass was clear, and I was on the road, muttering imprecations about the ruthless nature of fairy queens as I drove back to the apartment. I heard the sirens a couple of blocks out. I nudged the accelerator as I came down the street toward the Svartalf embassy, suddenly anxious. I became a lot more anxious when I saw the haze of smoke in the air, and when I saw the fire department's emergency vehicles deploying onto the grounds. Anxiety blossomed into pure panic. Flames leapt 40 feet into the air above the compound as the building burned. The embassy was on fire, and my daughter was inside. Chapter 7 I parked the Monstermobile a block away and ran in.
I didn't really feel like being stopped by a well-meaning first responder, so I ran in under a veil. I also didn't feel like being away any longer than necessary, so I ran in at something like Olympic speed. It probably would have been more subtle if I hadn't vaulted the hood of the last police car in the way. The cop standing next to the driver's side door goggled and fumbled his radio, which I guess is understandable when something resembling a low-budget predator goes by. There's no point in having a soul-threatening source of power to draw on if you aren't going to draw on it when your daughter is in danger. That's exactly the reasoning that got you into this mess in the first place, Dresden, isn't it?
Shut up.
Me? The Svartovs must have disabled the wards all over the exterior grounds, or else CFD wouldn't have been able to get near the place. It must have pained Ostry to no end to lower the defenses for a gang of humans. I went by the little security shack outside the place and saw no one in it. The front door of the building was open, and smoke was billowing from it, hazing out everything more than 30 or 40 feet away. Two teams of firefighters with hoses had already deployed up to the door and were flooding the place with water, evidently preparing to work their way inside. I didn't feel like getting hosed down or set on fire, so I skirted the front door, circling the building. There was an emergency exit on the side of the building, and a secondary entrance in the rear where deliveries came in. The earth abruptly became liquid under my feet and forced me to slow my pace or pitch forward into it. The Svartovs manipulated earth the way mortals do plastic, only with magic, obviously, and I dropped my veil at once, lifting my hands.
Whoa! Whoa! It's me, Harry Dresden!
A Svartov's head came up out of the ground without any kind of accompanying illusion, enormous dark eyes blinking twice and staring at me.
Ah,
the Svartov said, rising higher out of the ground, and I recognized the voice. It was Etri's sister, Ivana, his second in command. Her hair was pale and so silken fine that it hung rather lankily around her head. More of her rose out of the ground, clothed in a simple shift the same color as her hair.
Wizard, I was told to watch for you. I need you to come with me.
My daughter, I said. I have to get to her.
Precisely,
Ivana said, her voice crisp. She held out her hand to me. I gritted my teeth and said, we're going to Earthwalk?
If you please, she said. I hate this, I said. No offense.
Then I took a deep breath and took her hand. I can earthwalk, technically. I mean, if I really, really, really wanted to, I could do it. Wizards can pull off almost anything other supernatural beings can do, if we want to work at it. But why would I want to? Ivana's hand pulled me down, and I sank into the ground as if it had suddenly become thick jello, dirt-flavored jello. We began moving, and the ground passed through us in the most unsettling way imaginable. I could feel the earth grinding at every inch of my skin, as if I was thrashing my way through fine sand, and my clothes didn't do a thing to stop the sensation. Worse, it gritted away at my eyelashes, forcing me to blink and hold my hand up over my eyes, which also did no good whatsoever. Worst was the phantom sensation of earth in my mouth and my nose and tickling at my throat. Technically, I think she was using magic to slide our molecules around and through those of the ground around us. Practically, I was enjoying the experience of a slow and torturous sand blasting, including getting punched in the taste buds with overwhelming mineral sensations. Seriously, it's revolting. We emerged from the earth into one of the residential corridors below the main building, which was presumably burning merrily somewhere above us. You couldn't have guessed it. There was no smoke in the air, no sound of any fire, no leak of water from above. I fought against the urge to spit as Ivana let go of my hand and looked up at my grimace with amusement.
Mortals find it unpleasant, I know. Do you need a cup of water?
I lifted an eyebrow and looked down at her. Way, way down. Ivana was 6 inches shorter than Karen,
though the two of them shared something in the way of the same solid muscular frame.
Are you patronizing me?
Wizard? Would I do such a thing? She started walking, and I set out behind her.
I'm not familiar with his level, I said.
We're a level below our guest apartments and staff homes. These are the family quarters, Ivana replied. Etri, myself, our mates and children, a few cousins from time to time, she said. Her feet made no sound on the stone floor. Shouldn't everyone be leaving, you know, the fire and all?
Ivana cocked her head to look back and up at me.
We took precautions.
Precautions?
With guests like yourself, it seemed wise, she said. Her delivery was stone-faced, completely dry. We had heard rumors of other buildings burning down. The upper levels have been isolated from the quarters below. If the administrative offices burn to a pile of ash, it will not touch these levels.
I let out a breath and a sharp exhale, a sound of relief. She inclined her head to me.
Your daughter is safe.
We assume.
What do you mean, you assume? I asked. Once the fire began, security forces attempted to enter your quarters, she said. The Guardian would not permit us to remove her.
I suddenly felt a little sick. Mouse, you guys didn't...
Ivana stared hard at me for a moment, then her expression softened very slightly. No, of course not. The character of the Temple Guardians is well known. We would never desire to harm such a being unless at great need. And we do not harm children. That is why I was sent to watch for you.
I arched an eyebrow.
Wait, you're saying that you couldn't go get her?
Ivana shrugged a slender shoulder.
The Guardian seemed very determined.
I walked a few steps, thinking.
She was right about Mouse. He was a good dog, or maybe even a good dog.
But he had an unerring ability to determine when someone or something was hostile. He'd die before he let any harm come to Maggie. Which meant that if Mouse was defending her from the Svartals, I had to consider that they might be up to something he considered to be no good. They were very insular people, and they weren't human. They might not necessarily think or feel about things the way I would expect them to. I'd lived among them for a time now, and while I was comfortable interacting with them, I wasn't fool enough to think that I knew them.
Ivana stared up at my face as I thought, and I suddenly realized that she was reading my expression. Her own face went completely blank, completely empty of any emotion, as she regarded me.
What's going on here? I asked her carefully.
You tell me, she said.
I made an exasperated sound.
Hell's bells, Ivana, how should I know? I've been at my girlfriend's all evening. I just got here.
She turned abruptly in front of me, confronting me exactly as if I wasn't 2 feet taller and 200 pounds heavier than her.
Stop, she said firmly.
I did. She narrowed her eyes and said,
Say that again.
Why is everyone so shocked that I have a girlfriend? I asked.
She closed her eyes for a moment, as if silently counting to 3, and opened them again.
Not that part. Your explanation of events.
Oh, I said. I began to speak, but stopped myself at the last second and took a moment to think. I'd only met Ivana in passing, but she was looking remarkably intense by Svartalf standards, which is to say, she was working as hard as she could to give away nothing by her expression or her body language. I had to wonder what else she was concealing. I looked around us. Then I focused and used my wizard senses, looking deeper. I could feel the energy moving around us, feel the disturbances in the stone beneath my feet in several discrete locations. Ivana wasn't alone. There were half a dozen of the embassy's security personnel shadowing us, earthwalking through the safety of the stone.
The Svartovs were being polite about it, and had sent a pretty and charming captor to round me up, but subtle or not, I suddenly realized that I was a prisoner being escorted, and that my next words were going to count for more than most. In moments like this, I generally try to tell the truth, because I don't have the intellectual horsepower to keep track of very many lies. They add up. "I've been at my girlfriend's all evening," I said. "I just got here. I don't know what's going on." As I spoke, her eyes closed. She opened them again slowly after I finished speaking and said quietly,
"You speak the truth."
"No kidding," I blurted. "Ivana, I know I'm a guest, but you are officially starting to freak me out. I want to see my daughter, please."
"You are under guest right," she said quietly. Then she nodded once and said, "This way."
We went up the stairs, down a hall, and through a set of doors, and were suddenly in territory I recognized, the hall outside of the apartment. There were a number of Svartov's security staff gathered outside the door, and they were talking among themselves as Ivana and I approached.
"Doesn't make any sense," one of them said. "The lock is disengaged. It should open." "It must be a spell holding the lock closed," said another.
The first twisted the doorknob by way of demonstration. It turned freely the way unlocked doorknobs do.
"Behold? A ram, then," said the second.
"You'd ruin the wood," I told them as we approached, "and you still wouldn't be able to get past." The second Svartov rounded on me with a scowl.
"You installed additional security precautions without notifying security?"
"Clearly."
"That is explicitly against our corporate policy."
"Oh, get over it, Gedwig," I said. "For a guy who puts magical landmines all over his lawn, you're being awfully sensitive."
"You could have threatened the safety of everyone here."
I shook my head. "It's a completely passive plane of force. Extends across the walls on either side, too. Won't hurt anyone, and you'd need a tank to break it down." And it had cost me a very long weekend of work installing it. Gedwig scowled.
"This display of your distrust could be considered an insult to Svartov hospitality."
"My distrust," I blurted. "Are you freaking kidding me?" I cocked an eyebrow, turned to Ivana, and asked, "By any chance, does your people's tongue not have a word for irony?"
"Peace, Gedwig," Ivana said. "Mr. Dresden, can you open the door?"
"It's easy if you have the key," I said. I produced the metal door key from my pocket and flipped it around so that she could see the pentacle inscribed on its base. "I think it would be best if I went in alone to talk to Mouse, all right?" Ivana nodded once. "So be it."
"But my lady," Gedwig began.
She flicked a hand up, palm toward him, and the guard shut his mouth instantly. I nodded and touched the key to the doorknob. The energy bound in the key was conducted through the metal into the plane of force beyond it, disrupting its flow and shorting out its field. "Be right back," I said, and opened the door while watching the two security guys. Gedwig looked like he wanted to push in past me, but he held his position behind Ivana as I entered and shut the door behind me.
"Dad," Maggie said, "you're home. What's happening?"
My daughter was sitting on the dinner table, as close to the middle of it as she could get, and her babysitter, Hope Carpenter, sat next to her with an arm protectively around her shoulders. Mouse was pacing steadily around the table, his head down, nose waffling. He glanced up at me once and shook his ears a little by way of greeting before returning to his rounds. "Harry," Hope said. She was a very serious young woman to whom adolescence had been uncommonly generous. Having become an expert father and all over the past 3 or 4 months, I had new insights into how worried Michael would be about how his lovely dark blonde daughter might be treated, especially given that... Stars and stones, Maggie wasn't all that much younger than Hope, really. In a few more years, would I be the one writhing with protective parental concern? I would. And that thought was fairly terrifying.
or maybe humiliating, or both. Oh, you already have trouble enough on your plate without borrowing more, Dresden.
Hey, Hobbit, I told her, gave them my most reassuring smile. How come you guys are up on the table?
Because they keep trying to come through the floor and get us, Maggie said, her voice wavery with fright.
Just then, Mouse whirled his entire body around, his gray mane flying. Maybe 3 feet to one side of the table, the stone floor suddenly rippled, and a Svartalf began earthwalking up out of the ground.